Deputy Prime Minister of Sweden and the former head of Sweden's Social Democratic Party, as well as the former UN Special Representative on Sexual Violence and Conflict. They were speaking this weekend at a conference I moderated in Venice, Italy, talking about a new era for human rights. The conference organized by the Global Campus of Human Rights and Right Livelihood to mark the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. As the conference ended, thousands of Venetians went out in boats. We joined them to celebrate the city's oldest holiday, marking the end of the 16th century plague, the pestilence that killed a third of Venice's population. There was a half-hour fireworks display as people celebrated. I'm Amy Goodman, back in New York. Thanks for joining us.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
3 summers ago, Portlanders stood united in demanding changes to the institution of policing and the Portland Police Bureau. Since then, the Police Accountability Commission has been building a proposal for a new voter-mandated, civilian-led police oversight system. For the July edition of Totality of Circumstances, members of the PAC will be live in the KBOO studio to field your questions and comments before their final plan goes to the City Council at the end of August. Tune in and give us a call on Tuesday, July 25th from 5 to 6 p.m. or send us an email at totalityradio@gmail.com. That's totalityradio@gmail.com or join us live on Tuesday, July 25th from 5 to 6 p.m.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a federal judge says Oregon gun control measure 114 is constitutional, but opponents enter an appeal.
Two Oregon mayors resigned last week for posting hateful content on social media.
And activists say Oregon needs to do more to protect whales on the coast.
Good evening.
On Friday, a federal judge in Oregon ruled that a new state gun law does not violate the U.S. Constitution. Today, two gun store owners and two gun rights advocacy groups appealed the decision. U.S. District Court Judge Karen Immigut ruled that ballot measure 114 is constitutional. The measure passed narrowly in November of 2022. It strengthens background checks and prohibits the sale and transfer of ammunition magazines holding more than 10 rounds. Since its passing, Measure 114 has faced many legal challenges, with many gun rights activists arguing that it impedes on the Second Amendment and the right to keep and bear arms. After the hearing each side's arguments, Judge Immigut decided that Measure 114 is constitutional because large-capacity gun magazines are, quote, not commonly used for self-defense and are therefore not protected by the Second Amendment, end quote. Immigut also stated that, quote, magazines are an accessory to firearms rather than a specific type of firearm, end quote. Even though the federal judge said Measure 114 is constitutional, it's not in effect yet. A Harney County District Court judge has temporarily blocked the measure's implementation because of a legal challenge. That case is set for trial in September.
Two Oregon mayors resigned last week after receiving backlash for hateful posts on social media. Baker City Mayor Matt Diaz resigned on Thursday. This is after he posted an anti-LGBTQ meme on Facebook comparing queer activists to Nazis. Diaz defended his actions in the days following his post. Baker City Council member Beverly Calder made a motion to force Diaz to resign, but it was deadlocked in a 3-3 vote. Diaz eventually did resign at the end of the 3-hour council meeting, but not because of the backlash. He said he would be moving out of town and therefore couldn't be mayor. The other Oregon mayor to resign last week was Newport Mayor Dean Sawyer. His resignation came after OPB reported on dozens of hateful posts he made to a private police Facebook group. They revealed that Sawyer posted memes mocking immigrants, Spanish speakers, and trans people. Sawyer said the post, quote, "Do not reflect my values. It was wrong for me to belittle people with experiences different than my own," end quote. Now, Newport City Council President Jan Kaplan will serve as acting interim mayor until someone else can be appointed to serve out Sawyer's term.
Whales are getting entangled in fishing gear off Oregon's coast. While the state is considering measures to reduce entanglements, one conservation group says they don't go far enough. Eric Tegedoff reports.
A conservation group is calling on Oregon to do more to protect whales from fishing gear. Ben Itticknapp is the Pacific Campaign Manager and Senior Scientist with the organization Oceana. He says Dungeness crab pots off the coast of Oregon entangle whales. There were 333 confirmed whale entanglements off the coast between 2012 and 2022, according to federal numbers. Itticknapp notes many of these incidents are fatal.
Sometimes the animals will continue to swim and feed while they're wrapped in the pots for up to about 6 months before the entanglement ultimately becomes fatal. It's a long and slow and sometimes agonizing way for these magnificent creatures to go.
On August 4th, the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission will consider taking action to reduce entanglements. But Oceana says the proposed measures don't go far enough. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife implemented the new measures on a trial basis in 2021 and 2022, but didn't see a drop during that period. Itticknapp says the state could take a number of steps to better protect whales.
We need to remove those vertical lines that are in the water, and you can do that with time and area closures, so closing areas when the humpback whales are feeding off of our coast during the times that they're feeding here. Also reducing the number of pots that are allowed to be set in the ocean.
He also says technology makes it possible to rid the ocean of crabbing pot lines. Itticknapp says the crab fisheries are important, but so are the whale populations, including the endangered humpback whales that feed off the coast.
That's where we're at, is to ask the commission to chart that path forward that can work for the ocean wildlife and a sustainable fishery. But right now, we're just not there yet.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Portland celebrated Pride in July for the first time last weekend on the heels of a record-breaking drag show at their Cell 15 showplace. Over 60 performers came together to break the Guinness World Record for the longest continual drag performance. They succeeded, performing for 48 hours, 11 minutes, and 30 seconds. That blew the previous record out of the water by 11 hours. To accomplish this, performers took turns on stage for an average of 12 songs each. It was a sold-out show, 4,900 tickets for two-hour blocks of performances. The Dragathon show was envisioned to help support the queer community after a number of laws targeting gay and trans rights were passed around the country. The record was broken by the afternoon of July 12th, and nearly $300,000 were raised for the Trevor Project, a nonprofit that supports LGBTQ+ youth.
A major bicycle and pedestrian network under consideration in Southwest Oregon. It's part of an effort coordinated by the Oregon Department of Transportation, or ODOT, the U.S. Forest Service, and FHWA Western Federal Lands. The bike network will likely be named the Rogue Umpqua Bicycle and Pedestrian Corridor. Designers envision a 172-mile route connecting Roseburg to Crater Lake, then ending southwest on Highway 62 to Eagle Point. ODOT and the Forest Service jointly applied for funds through the Federal Lands Access Program. They say the improvement should be viewed in relationship to post-wildfire recreation and recovery. In fact, the corridor will likely include view sheds, areas where public can witness forest recovering from wildfires. The groups will use the next 2 years to better understand the current and future bike and pedestrian use, prepare designs, and assess costs. Those designs could include anything from improved shoulder space with painted bike lanes to off-highway trails. There's other tasks, too, like gathering stakeholder input, documenting existing conditions, and collecting travel data to better understand anticipated demand.
Public transit fares are set to increase in Portland early next year. The decision was a controversial one. Opponents say this has implications for low-income residents and the environment. Eric Tegadoff has the details.
Despite an approved fare increase, a campaign continues to look for other ways to fund public transit in Portland. In front of a crowd of loud protesters in May, the TriMet board voted to approve a 30-cent increase to 2.5-hour fares. Ellie Gluhusky with Opal Environmental Justice Oregon says fare increases are an unreliable source of revenue. She and other organizers in Portland say the city should consider increasing the payroll tax by 1% on people with salaries above $250,000 instead.
That will bring in enough revenue for the agency to completely subsidize fares, so go fareless, and also have some leftover for labor, electrification of the bus fleet, etc. And will also make that tax more progressive.
TriMet says operating costs have increased more than 4% per year over the past decade and argue the fare increase will keep pace with costs. Before the vote, Mayor Ted Wheeler urged the board not to increase fares, citing the disproportionate impact on low-income residents. The new fares go into effect in January. Jay Amechi with Freedom to Thrive in Portland says people of color will feel the brunt of the financial burden from increased fares most.
Visually, you can see that the majority of the riders on these buses are people of color, are black people, are immigrants and refugees.
Gluhusky says this decision also has implications for the climate by potentially leading more people to drive instead of riding public transit.
We need to be approaching decisions from a framework of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, protecting our climate, and ensuring that our communities are going to be protected in the face of the changing climate. And making transit less accessible by increasing fares moves in the opposite direction of that.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegadoff.
Washington State Department of Corrections workers say they're being denied a $1,000 pandemic-related bonus. They're urging state leadership to follow through on their promise. KBOO's Grant Button has more.
Washington State Corrections workers are calling on the state to keep their word and deliver on pandemic-related bonuses. More than 400 union members of the Washington Federation of State Employees who work at the Department of Corrections say they've been informed that they won't get a $1,000 recognition and retention lump sum negotiated in their latest contracts. Jim Furcher is a community corrections officer and union steward.
$1,000 may not seem like that much money to some folks, but to some of our lower income folks, our support staff folks that aren't making oftentimes a family wage in my mind, $1,000 is a huge amount of money.
The bonus is for workers who were employed on or before July 1st, 2022 and remained employed a year later. The Department of Corrections referred questions about the payment to the Office of Financial Management, which said it had no comment because it anticipates litigation over the matter. Furchert says workers earned that pay while working during COVID-19. He says arrests were still being made at the height of the pandemic, meaning corrections officers had to transport people to prison or jail.
In that transport, you're in a car with a person you don't know their COVID status. You don't know what they had. I can't think of a CCO or a community corrections officer or even a correctional specialist that didn't get COVID during the pandemic because we were still out doing the work.
Furchert says corrections workers in the state are implementing changes to the system that are making people's lives better.
The Washington State Community Corrections Division is one of the most progressive in the nation for some of the techniques we're using and some of the practices we're doing. I mean, we're really doing groundbreaking programs and groundbreaking approaches to attempt to impact behavior change.
Washington Federation of State Employees have written a petition to leadership in the state that the public can sign. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Grant Button.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Sol Mora, the advocacy director at the Coalition of Communities of Color, about a rally tomorrow morning at City Hall opposing efforts by city commissioners to change the government reform Portland voters passed last fall. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, let's talk about race. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 60 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be warm and sunny with a high of 85. Today in history, in 2020, Representative John Lewis passed away. Lewis was an American politician and civil rights leader. He participated in many key actions of the civil rights movement, including leading the first of three Selma to Montgomery marches. He represented Georgia in Congress from 1986 to 2020. The quote of the day is from Lewis, who said, quote, "Freedom is not a state, it is an act. It is not some enchanted garden perched high on a distant plateau where we can finally sit down and rest. Freedom is a continuous action we all must take, and each generation must do its part to create an even more fair, more just society."
Teamsters at shipping giant UPS hold a practice picket in anticipation of a nationwide strike. Hollywood actors join striking writers in their quest for a better pay and protections from A1. And farmers face significant losses from historic flooding in the Northeast. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Your fight right here is about being the tip of the spear for dignity for every worker in this country. Every worker in this country.
Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York rallies Teamsters employed by shipping giant UPS as they prepare for a possible strike next month. Contract talks broke down last week, in large part over wages for part-time workers. UPS handles about a quarter of U.S. parcel delivery and says it will begin training non-union employees to step in. Hollywood is on hold as actors join striking film and television writers. SAG-AFTRA President Fran Drescher says negotiations with the studios deadlocked on streaming pay and the use of artificial intelligence.
If we don't stand tall right now, we are all going to be in trouble. We are all going to be in jeopardy of being replaced by machines.
This marks the first tandem writers and actors strike since 1960. Historic flooding in the Northeast has caused significant damage to farms and closed miles of roads and rail lines. State officials in Vermont, Connecticut, and Massachusetts warn that cases of total crop loss, some just days from harvest, could impact the regional food supply. Congresswoman Becca Ballant represents Vermont.
We were driving down from the airport, saw lots of cropland that has been destroyed.
Combined with record wildfires and heat waves, climate scientists say intense flooding is at least partially tied to global warming. They say they expect extreme weather to become closer to a new normal around the world. House Republicans have passed a sweeping defense policy bill with controversial amendments preventing abortion care and diversity initiatives. Democrats say the traditionally bipartisan bill has been hijacked by extremists and stands no chance in the Senate. But House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says it includes a needed pay raise, and he defended the policy positions.
A military cannot defend themselves if you train them in woke. We don't want Disneyland to train our military.
Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas says women in the military seeking an abortion should take leave if they are stationed where it is banned. The Reverend Jesse Jackson is stepping down from leading civil rights group, the Rainbow Push Coalition. Congressman Jonathan Jackson, the Reverend's son, says his father will still fight for economic and social justice.
There is no word in the Bible, there's no place in the Bible for retirement. So as long as God gives him strength, he'll keep on fighting.
And finally, in a new poll from the Associated Press, just 1 in 10 give high marks to American democracy. A majority of adults say economic, gun control, and immigration laws are out of step, and more than half say Congress is doing a bad job of upholding democratic values. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights will investigate voting access for Native voters in South Dakota. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and the Commission's South Dakota Advisory Committee have been at work probing voter access in the state. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's C.J. Keene has more on the report that found voter access gaps, particularly on reservations.
The bipartisan 11-member commission has spent the last 2 years questioning the state's voting access from a civil rights perspective. Travis Lettler is an economist and the chair of the state advisory committee. He says after careful consideration, they have an answer.
sometimes if you live on a tribal area or you live on a reservation, your local polling place might be a county seat that might be prohibitively far to drive to vote. And then when you try to maybe do an early vote, what if you have a non-standard address where you might, again, live on tribal land where you don't actually have a post office?
Difficulty with voter ID regulations proves not every access challenge is geographic in nature.
One of the recommendations that the committee said was, what if the South Dakota Secretary of State published a simple one-page infographic that could go out to county auditor's office, polling locations, that was just showing up to vote, question mark, here's what you need to bring. Don't have an ID, question mark, that's okay, here's what you do. It might cost a little bit of money to print them off, but the gain to the average voter outweighs the cost of printing an infographic.
These recommendations aren't legally binding. Federal civil rights analyst Mallory Trachtenberg says these findings will now be shared with lawmakers and federal officials. But that doesn't mean the end of the discussion.
They're emotionally charged topics. You know, civil rights is really challenging to continue to have a conversation about these days. And I will highlight that, you know, people could walk away from these conversations, but continue to have those conversations. It can be really painful, but the fact that they're still here and so many active committees doing this, it's pretty impressive.
Every state and territory in the country has a similar advisory committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. For National Native News in Rapid City, I'm CJ Keene.
It's called Weaving Our Pride, a year-long blanket weaving project in Juneau, Alaska, to celebrate the LGBTQ+ community, led by master clinket weaver Lily Hope. Hope says the project gives youth of all identities and supportive adults a chance to sit side by side to create a shared work celebrating pride, community, and self. Over the next year, a team of 6 weavers will spend several days a week at the Zach Gordon Youth Center assisting in making 2 blankets, one in the traditional raven's tail style and the other in the more modern Chilkat style.
We're going to do bands of rainbow color and do a follow the leader kind of deal. So the mentor weaver will weave one row and the student will come behind and weave exactly the same row. Anyway, it's going to be pretty epic.
Next summer, dancers will wear them for the first time at Celebration, a biennial Southeast Native Dance Festival held in Juneau. After Celebration, the robes will remain at the youth center and be worn for special ceremonies that include new names and coming out parties, as well as significant pride events. Only young people can wear them.
The cool thing is that 3 of these 6 mentor weavers identify as queer. 1 mentor weaver has queer children, and the space that's being held by these weavers is safe, healing, affirmative, inspiring.
Hope believes projects like Weaving Our Pride can bring positive, lasting change to the community. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Women's rights groups are urging the public not to back down in what they see as an ongoing battle to defend academic freedom and the broader struggle for social justice in Florida and beyond. Some Republican lawmakers are initially called for a ban on teaching the future of gender and women's studies. Trimmel Gomes has the story.
Women's rights advocates are crediting students, educators, and organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union for fighting measures that would have banned gender and women's studies during Florida's legislative session. One Republican-backed higher education bill sought to prohibit degree programs related to critical race theory, gender studies, and intersectionality. But impacted groups mobilized and rallied against it at the Capitol and signed petitions, forcing sponsors to make the bill less explicit and prescriptive about where material should be excluded from the curriculum. Carsonia Wise Whitehead with the National Women's Studies Association says, despite the changes, it is troubling to see the notion of curriculum banning gaining traction.
We have to remain vigilant because this is, I would say, not the beginning of a long battle. We are only in the first inning of what is going to be a long battle to make sure that the free spaces of education that we have, that they are not taken away from us.
Senate Bill 266, which went into effect July 1, calls for a college and university course review. Classes could be barred if they include theories that systemic racism, sexism, oppression, and privilege are inherent in the institutions of the United States and were created to maintain social, political, and economic inequities. Republican State Senator Aaron Grawl, who sponsored the bill, said nothing in this bill bill is meant to prohibit speech or to keep facts from being presented. National groups argue the so-called attacks on education are not just isolated to Florida, but are part of a nationwide effort by reactionary politicians and organizations to suppress critical examinations of gender, race, and sexuality. Whitehead believes this struggle impacts every aspect of education, from PK through 12 to college.
There is something very disturbing about seeking to control a place that's designed to teach you how to think creatively, which is the higher ed environment. That is one of the main purposes of college.
Whitehead believes there will be future efforts to ban these topics. Senator Grawl was unavailable for an interview. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
Seabirds are dying and ocean heat waves may be to blame. Mass mortality rates occur a few months after a significant increase in ocean temperature, according to a University of Washington study. KBOO's Grant Button has more on the story.
Ocean heat waves are correlated to mass die-offs of seabirds. That's according to a new study released by the University of Washington. Coastal residents collected data from California to Alaska over a 28-year span. The study found that the seabird die-offs were statistically linked to warmer ocean temperatures. This is because warmer water promotes harmful algae blooms. It increases the likelihood of disease outbreaks and also changes the type, abundance of, and nutritional value of the seabird's prey. Between 2014 and 2019, there were 5 mass mortality events of 250,000 birds or more. This previously happened only once a decade. Timothy Jones was the lead author of the report. Jones said, quote, "This is unprecedented. This type of massive die-off can be compared to a catastrophic storm that we would usually expect once per decade. They happen, causing massive damage, but usually there is enough time for areas to recover," end quote. Seabird survival is especially bleak near Alaska as retreating sea ice causes warmer ocean temperatures. This study is one of only a few in the field, bringing to light the effects of climate change on seabird survival. For KBOO News, I'm Grant Bunn.
The flu-like valley fever is on the rise, and there is a climate leak. About 20,000 cases were reported to the CDC in 2019. That's 7 times the number in 20 years prior. And Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Valley fever is a flu-like illness that's growing increasingly common across hot, dry regions of California and the Southwest. In 2019, about 20,000 cases of valley fever were reported to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That's about 7 times more cases than were reported just 20 years ago. Daniel Tong is an associate professor at George Mason University. He explains that valley fever is caused by inhaling a soil-dwelling fungus called coccidioides.
What we know is that soil is the place the fungus will grow.
Valley fever outbreaks have been reported at construction sites and archaeological digs, where people come in close contact with loose soil particles. And Tong's research finds a correlation between the rising number of valley fever cases and intensifying dust storms, in which dry, windy conditions cause large amounts of soil and sand to billow into the air. He says as the climate warms, dust storms are becoming more common in the western U.S.
We are seeing more and more droughts, so we are seeing more dust storms,
which means the risk of contracting valley fever could continue to grow. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 17th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Grant Button. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Tramell Gomes, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of these newscasts is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ender Black.
And I'm Danny Shy. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. In November of 2022, Portland voters passed a remarkable